good evening, everybody, and welcome to Let's Talk Assassin's Creed, your number one podcast for all things Assassin's Creed.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 138 of Let's Talk Assassin's Creed. Before I introduce the episode title, I'm going to first welcome our special guest. Welcome back. You've been already chatting to us recently twice, I think, in the last 6 weeks. It's great to have you back on the show again, Andrew from Visions of the Past.
Thanks for having me. It feels like you're right. I think it has been almost once a month for the last couple months, and it's been great chatting with you guys. I really enjoy it.
Oh, same. And for this topic, it was having you on the show for the Templar episode, and then we were talking about replayability. And when we were chatting about replayability, we didn't really talk about replayability, and we had Arshak on the show as well, and it was a great conversation. But we spent about 30 minutes talking about Swords of Eden. Before getting on with the main event. And that then prompted a thought in my head. Hang on a minute, there's a topic I'd like to address, and there's really only one man suitable for the job, which is you, because your knowledge of this franchise and the lore, and the transmedia in particular, is superb. And what I will say before we get into it, I need to give a shout out to your podcast, Andrew, which is called Visions of the Past, which I spent the last 4 weeks or so binge listening to and filling in lots of gaps and stuff in my knowledge. And I definitely recommend it to anyone who's listening to us who wants even more Assassin's Creed content. Where can they find you, Andrew?
Well, the quickest place to find everything would be on my Linktree, just linktr.ee/visionsofthepast, I think. It's been a long time since I've used that one. But you can always find it on my Twitter, visions_AC. Oh, goodness. Now I don't even know my Twitter. Oh, no.
Quick, let's look it up.
Visions_AC. Right. Yes.
Nice. Yeah, have a look at Andrew's Twitter profile. Follow his Linktree. Have a listen to his show. It's really, really good. And let's get to the topic. So we're going to be talking about the lore of Assassin's Creed, which is always an interesting topic. But in particular, I'm kind of saying this with a big smile on my face, we're going to be talking about the lore of Assassin's Creed and Assassin's Creed Odyssey. What did it expand? What did it change? Did it break the lore? Did it make good choices? Did it tell the lore in new and interesting ways? Let's just get a first impression. I mean, I'll tell you my story, as I've said on the show before, but I'll repeat it briefly. This was my first game in the franchise, and I didn't know anything about the franchise other than I'd seen occasional pictures of Ezio. I didn't know he was called Ezio. It was just the guy in the white and red robes. And I was dumped into this Greek war simulator, and it was a fantastic action adventure across the ancient Greek world. And the main game, at least, apart from Herodotus telling you that he's found clues to people who came before, the main game treads very lightly on the pre-established lore, although it's expanded a lot, I think, in the add-on content like One of the Lost Tales of Greece and then the two DLC. So I'm curious to get your two's impressions, because you came to this game as experienced players and knowledgeable players. I mean, Declan, what did you think when you first fired up the game and played through it?
I thought I bought the wrong game. I'm into that sarcastically, but when you start playing as Leonidas in that mission, I was like, whoa, this is some 300 game, this is epic. But it's the only game in the franchise that I've never admitted in public, because I'm kind of worried about my opinions, that I actually believe showed how diverse the game series could be. Because I know we'll get into it later, but the choices mechanic, not the best thing that I enjoy, no, but it kind of just drives home how much this game really is just a computer simulation. It's not time travel. So it then asks the more questions, you know, how far can you change a simulation without it being breaking canon? And in my opinion, you can do anything with a simulation, because it's just a simulation. And, you know, I don't understand the whole debacle of it broke the law. From the 15 years I've played the series, I've never found anything, to my knowledge, in Odyssey that breaks the law, but I'm probably wrong.
I mean, that seems like a perfect segue to Andrew. Andrew, what was your kind of, what did you know going into the game, and then what were your impressions as you played through it the first time?
going into the game, that came out in 2018, right? I believe that was my
October.
First year doing the Reddit marathon, playing from one to the new release. So the day before, I had just finished Origins, picked up the game and started Odyssey. And I went, okay, this is a little weird, a little different, but difference is okay, because we've seen different things throughout the game. And when they brought out the choices for the dialogue, I went, okay, that's not too far different than me sneaking into the Citadel or you full on attacking the Citadel. We're all just two different ways to get to the same goal. But once they started going in with different endings and different romance options, and you could do this and you could do that, it, as Declan said, pushed forward that idea that this is a simulation, that you are truly someone sitting in an Animus, except they take so long to get to you to that point that you don't know that for the longest time. I think the prologue's 2 hours. It's nothing like Valhalla's prologue, but I wouldn't say that it broke the lore, but I can understand why people say that, because it's got that misconception that you think you're time traveling, that you're doing the past in the way that you want it. You don't realize you're just living a simulation. That's the issue I see with multiple genders for your protagonist. You're not breaking the lore by playing Alexios, because you're living a simulation using the avatar of Alexios through Cassandra's life.
See, I the first time I played through, at least until like two-thirds of the way through, because perhaps this is a valid criticism of Odyssey, although I think Origins, honestly, is very, very similar. And I do find it odd that people will praise Origins and then criticize Odyssey, but I see them as being fairly similar in their structure. Origins only pulls you out of the Animus two or three times, as does Odyssey. And because it happens so rarely, when you are pulled out of the Animus, my reaction, I'm sure like lots of first-time players, was, I don't remember this. Who is this lady? And what's happened to my ancient Greek war simulator that I spent the last 50 hours playing?
Yep.
That's definitely a, I don't know if you call it a pacing criticism or a story criticism, but yeah, it's very easy as a brand new player, which I was, very easy to forget how it was framed. Although once I came to understand that it was, okay, they both touch the spear, so the spear has the DNA of Alexios and Cassandra. The Animus is, yeah, I mean, it's not, we're not, this is the bit that I always felt was acceptable with dialogue choices. The Animus is rebuilding or building a simulation based on the DNA as best it can, and then it fills in the gaps. And the further back in time you go, the more the DNA degrades, therefore the more gaps there are, therefore the more freedom you can have as a game to have some fun, have some choices or whatever. That's how I came to understand it. By the time I got to the end of the game and had done some reading and some more understanding of how these different things fitted together. Dialogue choices, I didn't know that. I know they're very divisive, but I always felt that mostly it was okay, because yeah, we might not have known how Cassandra decided to react to the situation. So the Animus is saying, well, how do you want to react, Layla? You're in the simulation, and we'll extend the simulation depending on what you choose.
So, and that's how they marketed it. They really marketed it as, this is the first one you can make story choices on. The problem, in my point of view, is that they didn't explain how the choices got made. Because if you're doing the story progression and all of that, like the previous games, everything's been lore. It's been set stone, canon, you are reliving a DNA, so you can't change it. But they give you that option. What they don't tell you is that it's because of Layla's advancement in the Animus HR point, HR 8.5. It, because you don't have that in Origins, which is she just uses standard HR 8. They don't tell you that they're filling those gaps from the DNA with, but the gaps are filled with Cassandra's DNA, Alexios' DNA, and information they got out of Herodotus's lost histories. They don't tell you that. So you're meant to believe everything that you do is canon because it's your Odyssey. And that's how they marketed it. You're playing your Odyssey.
I think maybe I'm just the only, I don't know how to word this, but when it came to like how Layla's Animus worked in Origins, I mean Odyssey, it kind of didn't feel weird to me. It kind of felt normal because I keep remembering how Black Flag was originally built as them using someone's DNA memory and then chopping and changing bits to make a video game. So naturally to me, when I started to see like, well, there's DNA choices, there's gender choices, you know, there's like Animus hacks and stuff like that I've been in before, it kind of feels so natural that it should have been there earlier, because if Black Flag toyed the idea that you can turn memories into video games, which I believe is also something in the first issue of one of the Transmedia canon comics, Charlotte is playing.
Yeah, Charlotte's playing the Helix system. It's the same system that you use in Unity and Syndicate.
So they're kind of like memories that Animus have just toyed with to try and find information. So the idea of Layla, who works with the Animus people and the Templars, creating an Animus that can change a simulation based on data or to try and fill in data blanks, or just, you know, scream, heck, I want to know what would happen if Cassandra was the one who fell off a cliff, so it was Alexios, let's replay the simulation, but with Alexios taking center stage. To me, that's been set in canon since Assassin's Creed Black Flag, and I know I'm going to get a lot of stick for that.
You won't from me, because you're absolutely right. As time goes on, technology improves. It is a logical choice to eventually open up that far. But when you're someone like James who just starts, you have no basis of knowing anything about DNA memory or what the Animus does. You're just thrown into this world and you're told to have fun. Then you get pulled out and you go, wait, what? Why? Why are we doing this?
We interrupt this live broadcast of your historical simulator for this weird bit you don't get.
Yep. And they started Unity, maybe a little bit with Black Flag. And you mentioned Black Flag as that editing software. And it's different from this one in the aspect that that Animus, the, I don't remember what they called it. But that Animus specifically let you replay someone else's memories, but you couldn't change anything. They did all that video game and movie stuff by basically video editing. They'd take your recordings and chop it up, and if they needed somebody to voice over, they'd do a voiceover, or they'd make some kind of CG change to desensitize it or make it into a movie. I mean, Liberation, the modern day story of Liberation is that it might not be in the game, but if you watch the Black Flag modern day, you see that Aveline's memories that you see is a video game edited from the memories of Animus Subject 1.
So it's not the first game, shall we say. It's not the first. we're in layers of Inception now, aren't we? Odyssey is not the first Assassin's Creed game to play loose with how genetic memories can be used and abused.
Yep. Yeah. I would say that. I would say that's a good way of putting it.
One of the things I didn't realize, and it's only much, much later, and I want to talk about the modern day a bit more. So Layla is, again, we only see it briefly, at least the first couple of times we come out of the Animus. She's in an apartment, a roof space somewhere in London.
Yeah, I think they just call it a London hideout.
Right, okay. She has a small team with her. Kiyoshi Takakura, Alana Ryan, and Victoria Bibeau. And Victoria Bibeau, we've known in the franchise since she's in the database file. She's in Heresy.
She's in Heresy, I'm still frustrated that they use that character because of her appearance in Heresy.
Mm.
Because the way they leave Heresy from my memory is that she was okay with being a Templar, and she knew everything that was going on, and she had no problem with what she was doing. And then, poof, I'm an assassin. I'm your doctor. Here we go.
So fill in the gaps then. Is there no transmedia that covers the time from Heresy to Odyssey and why she may have changed her allegiance?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right.
I always thought she changed her allegiance because this is just books leaving cliffhangers, but the very end of Heresy, from what I remember, there is Rickman's on a plane and he's on about order some colour, can't remember what it was. But I always thought that was just like some sort of kill order, because he didn't like the fact that, forgot his name, just kind of like proved that the Templars were doing the way they are going is wrong. It wasn't the way that, it was the guy who got executed in Paris. Is it Malay? It wasn't the way he wanted things.
The only person I remember out of that was Simon Hathaway fixing the sword.
Mm.
Yeah, because apparently he once he did all those memories, from what I remember, because I actually love that book, he then escaped to get the sword to kind of prove that Malay wanted his Templars to run a certain way, not the way they're running now, and then everyone started to agree with him, including Otzoberg, but Rickman didn't agree with him, and then Rickman's on a plane saying, like, it's time to do code something, which I assumed was a kill order or something, to kill Simon Hathaway, because he's just made a mockery of him in the Inner Sanctum. I don't know.
I guess that would make sense, that if he put a kill order on that whole team, that Bibeau would go into hiding and eventually run into the assassins.
It's called
But Tim I mean, Hat. You have to collect, you have to cross the dots yourself on that one.
See, when I read Heresy, the way it was written, the way it ends, Rickian already knows what Hathaway is about to find. And I'm going to be honest with you right now, put on the spot, I can't remember what it is that Simon Hathaway finds. I know he repairs the sword, but he finds some other deeper truth, doesn't he, which Rickian already knows about. And that's why he gives him such a short time frame to complete his research, to put him under pressure, and I think to hopefully make him fail. But the way that the book ends with Rickian flying off to Madrid, it read to me like it was designed to lead directly into the story that we get in the film. Parts of which, or large parts of which, take place at the medical research facility in Madrid. But I may be joining the dots up too much there. But I think the timelines almost kind of work.
I think that's about right. I think, because I don't think we know how long he was at the Madrid facility. And that was 2016, and I think Heresy was 2014, 2015.
So it doesn't quite. Okay. I'm sure he flies around.
I'm not 100% sure. It's been a long time since I've read it.
Mm. And then the other two characters. So Alana Ryan, was she a new character created for this game?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, but Kiyoshi, he'd been pre-existing in the comics, I think.
Yes, he has. He was in Origins. He was in Uprising. He's actually in the Shaojun manga that I can't Dynasty, I think it's the name. So yeah, he's a fairly sizable character in the transmedia.
My mic wasn't working for a second. I just wanted to jump back to Simon Hathaway a sec. Apparently he's the one who sent Leila Hassan and Danae Jury to Egypt. But it was Leila's refusal to check in Abstergo that led the company to deploy a Sigma team. So
yep.
Leila's presence in Origins was Simon Hathaway's doing. Which is now weird, because that would mean that Victoria Bibeau must have still been working with Simon Hathaway in
that would 2017, yeah. So she was at the time, see if I remember this right. Layla at the time was a member of historical research, went on a mission for something in Cairo, and she wouldn't check in. She went AWOL to test her animus, finding Bayek's DNA, and then Deanna Greery, I don't remember how her last name is.
I think.
But she basically just ran medical support from the hotel until Sigma Team showed up. And then, like, I get why for the gameplay reason, but Sigma Team showing up in a cave in the middle of nowhere with compound bows.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I get it. You didn't want to make assets for or a function for rifles, so you had them use the equivalent of a hunter bow today. So it makes sense from a development point, but it just from a story lore perspective, I just kind of giggled.
They were just throwing in some grenades and walked away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I also thought it was a bit strange in Origins that Layla was out in the desert on her own. I mean, they're in the Katara Depression, which is a particularly dry, you know, inhospitable part of Egypt. I don't know. Maybe there's a main road nearby or a McDonald's or whatever. But even so, would you really go out there on your own? Anyway.
No, and they don't give you any of a lot of her backstory. Even after William Miles showed up, and for years I was like, that's not William. That's not how he sounds. That's not how he looks. And like, you have to dig through emails to go, oh, she was present at the 2011 Egyptian protests. She took time off from Abstergo. She's really close to Sophia Ricken, or was. And it's one of those things that ties everything together, really showing Olivier Garneau from Black Flag being murdered by someone who suspiciously looks like Aiden Pierce from Watch Dogs. Desmond's death, Alan Rickon's death. I feel like there was somebody else's death. Maybe Juno's? No, because that would have been before Juno's death. So, yeah, you have to dig through the computer to really look at her history to know anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll tell you, in the first time I played Odyssey in the modern day, I didn't know you could interact with the room. I didn't know there was interaction points on the laptop. I just, whenever it dumped me out of the Animus, I walked back the Animus and got straight back in because I just didn't. I know this sounds so stupid.
Why be bothered with it if you're not invested into the modern day story? You buy the game because you assume you're going to be a Spartan killing people. That's all. And then you get pulled out.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least with the older games, you are right away modern day. Like, the only one, Black Flag, is you get the prologue, which is like maybe half an hour to 45 minutes, and then you get pulled out. Same thing with Unity and maybe Syndicate, I don't quite remember. But the only one that, like, not the only one, like Black 2, like the whole Ezio trilogy, you start modern day. You have to do something before you can get in the Animus. And with 1, you're going through the Animus and it's not right. And then you get pulled out and you're told why it's not right. Of immediately course. Giving yeah. you those science fiction elements.
Yeah.
I've heard somewhere that for years, fans have been, well, not fans, but a lot of new players and a lot of fans have been asking for the Assassin's Creed to ditch the modern day from as early as AC3.
Yep.
That is a common thing you see. I mean, I spend a fair bit of time on Reddit, on the main Assassin's Creed subreddit and the Odyssey subreddit, and you see that quite often. I don't get the modern day. I don't know why it's there. Let me just do my ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, Viking simulator, pirate simulator, whatever, you know.
And they don't realize that's not Assassin's Creed. I mean, if you want that, go play Rise, Son of Rome.
But I think personally, and I'm not trying to like, I don't know how to word it, but I think this is probably one of the biggest hurdles the developers have actually got. And it's why I kind of respect the developers, the struggle, because they've got to make a franchise last, because that's how it works. If it dies and you're losing money, that's business. But they have to try and build a game to please fans, which would include a ton of modern day. That would make me happy. But they've got to please newer fans, and a lot of new fans will complain at modern day. Like, I had a friend who refused to play Assassin's Creed 3 because he didn't like the modern day from Assassin's Creed 1, 2, Brotherhood and Revelations. So he refused to touch 3 if it had any modern day in it.
3 probably had the best modern day of those first 5 games.
Yeah, but he refused to touch it because he didn't see the point. He wanted to play the history. So he boycotted the series for life. I last talked to him when Origins came out, and I was like, I don't think there's much modern day in it. And he was like, oh, well, I don't want to play it because of it. It's some crap modern day. So there is people out there who may have that struggle in modern day. So how is a developer like Ubisoft supposed to make a game that's going to cater to all the fans that have been playing for 15 years or 10 years or 3 or 4 that do want modern day, but also do it without upsetting these new fans that don't want modern day? And a lot of news articles will hit hard when you get forced out of an Animus because they say it breaks immersion. I don't think it does. I think it actually makes the game more immersive, in my opinion. And then with this now whole review bomb culture that goes on when people don't like something, it's just a minefield for Assassin's Creed to be in.
I think a lot of it comes with expectations.
Yeah,
you got to set the expectations.
I don't agree, because if someone doesn't like the modern day segments, first of all, they're generally a lot shorter than the historical simulation part of the game. But also, the modern day is at its best when it has relevance to the story. You know, we are exploring the genetic memories of the ancestors to accomplish something in the modern day. Usually it's finding whatever the MacGuffin is of that particular story. But that's fine. And instead of gradually minimizing the modern day more and more and more, I mean, like I said, I think you can play through Odyssey's main game in about 50 hours. You probably pulled out of the Animus 3 times. Of course you forget what you were doing, that you're in an Animus. But make the Animus front and center. Commit to it. Remind the player that they're in it, and remind them that they're in a reconstruction of a genetic memory. If you make it front and center, if you make the historical story tightly weaved together with the modern day story, whether that's pulling you in and out of the Animus regularly, or just like in Unity where Bishop talks over you, like over the intercom into your headset while you're in the Animus at certain points in the story, the more you invest in that storytelling, the more people will come to appreciate. If people don't appreciate it, fuck them, you know. Who cares? There's lots of other video games out there. If you've got a 50 hour game or a 30 hour game and you can't cope with 2 hours in one day, honestly, boo-hoo.
I think that comes down to marketing at the very beginning, because I think the last time I remember them marketing the modern day was Black Flag, because they I remember very vividly they talked about piracy and how historical piracy works. But on the flip side, you have these modern day things. So we talk about modern day pirating and what all of that means. So when it came time to get to Odyssey, they didn't talk about modern day at all. With Origins, they didn't talk about modern day. So when you spend 3 or 4 hours and then you get that first automatic pullout to find the DNA of Alexios and Cassandra, well, actually, no, it would have been right after the 300 mission, so like 20 minutes. Yeah. But then you can go upwards of 200, 300 hours before getting pulled out again. Because if I remember right, and I've only played Origins twice because it's a lot. If I remember right, they don't really tell you what they're looking for at the beginning. Only, and they don't tell you how they found what they found. They don't tell you much of any reason why you're going into the Animus. And then they don't pull you out again until you do one very specific mission that to Cassandra's story is a side mission. And you could spend hundreds of hours not getting there.
Yeah.
And forget, oh yeah, by the way, I'm actually an Egyptian woman sitting in a box.
Maybe don't put that on the marketing materials. In this game, you're playing as so-and-so in a box.
I like that though. I think one modern day thing they need to do in the next game, and I don't get how many people don't like it or how they do it, is pulling the Animus user into the simulation, just how Layla was pulled into Eivor's simulation through the memory fragments.
That was a good way to, I thought, to tie in the fact that you remember it, that you're still in the Animus.
I would love to see that more, but I would love to see like that integrated, even if it's like not memory streams, you know, even if it's just a certain point in the story where, you know, maybe like, okay, let's not pull them out of the Animus and do a talk in the modern day setting. What if we freeze frame the Animus and we load in the visual asset of the modern day character and then have an intercom chat? So you're still in the simulation, you could walk around the town a little bit, but you've got an intercom chat. So they're telling you like, okay, this is a certain point we may have reached. And then it fizzles back into the character. That way you're not leaving the history, so you're not breaking the immersion, but you're still getting a sense this is a simulation because your real character has been pulled into it while they discuss something. I would be interested in that a lot. Yeah.
That kind of sounds like a hybrid of the Animus anomalies from Valhalla and the Helix server bridge from Unity.
I was thinking that. Or the massive rift that you have at the end of the River Thames in Syndicate.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can't miss that from halfway across the city. And again, it's reminding you this is a simulation. And then you dive into a hidden, I guess what you call a hidden memory that tells you something about Juno. So this, I suppose those three are really good examples. Probably an example that didn't work for me, although again, it is connected, is the, is it an example? Yeah, kind of as an example. The hidden messages in Origins in the temples. Although the bit I never got was why Bayek never reacted to them when he was listening to them. But anyway.
Oh, the empirical truth.
Thank you. Couldn't think of the word, the empirical truth. So there's lots of creative ways that they have reminded the player you are in an Animus without pulling you out of the Animus, and I'd be up for more of that.
Yeah, and speaking of the Origins and stuff like the Trial of the Gods was another good way. If my memory serves, that was originally supposed to be part of Juno's story, and then it got dropped. But the fact that they basically put this big, giant Egyptian god in the desert and say, good luck, look at all the shininess from the Animus, that it's... There are ways to do it. There are absolutely ways to do it.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's use that amazing segue and transition into the Animus, and let's talk about Cassandra's story in Greece. We use a piece of Eden right from the start of the game. Is that the only... No, Ezio uses an apple, doesn't he, in Brotherhood? And Altair, of course, in AC1. So, oh no, does Altair actually use the apple in AC1, or does he just retrieve it from
used on you, and then he doesn't really touch it when the map shows up. Do you use it in two? No. You just kind of carry it around.
Yeah, and then in three you use it, don't you, to sort of zap your way across the city freezing.
Yeah, that's kinda how Brotherhood worked. And then there is the memory seals now the memory seals were an interesting way to do two memory sequences into one.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to your episode on memory seals, by the way. People should check that out.
Yeah, that one was fun to do.
But yeah, another way of using the Animus and, you know, Isu tech to blend and create interesting storytelling. But yeah, Cassandra has a spear, or a broken spear, we should say, from her grandfather, Leonidas, of King of Sparta. And we can use it right from the start of the game. And, well, this is where, of course, the novel differs from the game. But in the game, we can use it to power some magical ability. Is magical the right word, Andrew? What do you, and Declan, what do you think?
You know what? Abilities? I can see why people would say magic, but I have a feeling it's more technological because it involves her bloodline. So I would say it's more of the artifact reacting with her DNA. More than magic.
I'm going to be the absolute a-hole of the bunch and say it is magic because any science to a pre-scientific race is magic.
Okay, that's fair.
The correct answer, yes.
Sounds not like a line from Thor there, but I'll take it.
Not to be rude, you give a caveman a lighter and he's not going to go, it's a lighter, it's going to go, magic, witchcraft, quick fire. So, science is magic to someone who doesn't know what science is. And that's my answer for Assassin's Creed and Star
Wars. Yeah. Yeah,
but once they take that away from you in the crossover story, oh my goodness, does that game jump exponentially in difficulty?
Can I tell you a little secret? Now, to be fair, I'm not like an amazing player, but I have chained together many new game pluses in Odyssey. I have something stupid like 400 ability points, and for the longest time, I don't play Odyssey regularly now, but I will dip in, you know, once a week and just explore or do a side quest or whatever, because the gameplay is fun and I just love going back to it. But I actually don't play with any active abilities because my character is ridiculously overpowered.
You have a build that when Origins came out, they said you could eventually get to the point to where you could one hit with bare fists, the elephants. And that's kind of what your build sounds like.
It basically is. I can one shot, you know, a level 99 nightmare difficulty mercenary without using any abilities and all the rest of it. But to give me some balance, I use the engraving that gives you 25% health and I have no resistances. I believe the phrase is glass cannon.
Yes.
And it's a lot of fun. But certainly early on, you know, I loved the Spartan kick. I loved the bull rush, predator shot and all the rest of it. You know, as gameplay things.
How much fun is it to get up really high and just Spartan kick somebody off a cliff? Oh, I love that.
Never gets old.
That's how I killed Elpenor.
Oh, nice.
Then I went, oh no, dude, I need to loot him for that mask.
It's a long way down.
No fall damage.
I think that's personally what makes me love Odyssey a little bit more. Like, now listen to this, I really want to go out and buy Odyssey, but the fact of, like, the Peace of Eden has that extra gameplay element to make the game fun. Like, does it really matter if it's, like, super immersive to the sci-fi element of the game? Well, no, because if you take it out, I really think Odyssey would be a little bit more boring.
I think it would be too.
I adore the DLC ability where you can assassinate them and they just disappear. I'd chain that a lot. I love that. You just rush them, disappear, like, ha, I was never here. And then the cloak one, I love that. I got stealth. I make a Isu ninja.
Maybe this is the central point of discussion. You've got an established set of games with an established set of rules, let's say, on what gameplay can and can't be included in them. Odyssey bent that, stretched that a lot. But perhaps that was worth doing because it was fun. And aren't we here to have fun?
Well, I didn't, like, you get so many people that go, oh, well, this is Assassin's Creed. You should be playing as an assassin. And I'm that lore guy that raises your hand and goes, But Edward wasn't an assassin. He was a pirate until like the last hour.
I mean, the number of games where you don't play as an assassin, at least at the start, I think is equivalent to the number of games where you are an assassin at the start.
And ask people when Ezio was inducted into the Assassin Order.
Mm-hmm. Years. Ten after. Years. Yeah.
Yep. Ten years after he started. Almost at the very end of 2.
I've discussed this for years. Like, I don't know, you probably correct me that I'm wrong, but I will die on my hill that the Colonial Brotherhood was gone, except for Achilles. Technically, in my opinion, Connor never got a true rite of passage into the Brotherhood, is what we've seen. So even though he is an assassin by law, I still don't credit him as a full assassin because he didn't get the rite of passage into the Brotherhood that most assassins get. He was never truly inducted in the ways.
Even though his mentor goes, "You and I aren't one to stand on ceremony. Here you go."
Yeah, but
okay, Declan, you just picked a fight with someone who knows Assassin's Creed 3 very, very well.
No,
I wish you luck.
Like, I get where you're coming from. There should be the branding or the removal of a finger or something. I get where you're coming from.
I think that's just, I think it's what I call, like, is it important? No. Is he technically an assassin? No, he is an assassin. But from my mind, how the whole Assassin's Creed is built, you know, there's like a branding sort of thing. Like Ezio gets branded. Technically, Altair has been inducted. He then gets stabbed and had to rework his way up. So that was technically a sort of branding. Technically, Edward gets branded, I think. I don't know. I'm not
we
sure.
We don't see. I was going to call out Edward. All that happens is... all that happens. Atabai gives him the robes and says something like, "These suit you."
These suit you, though you haven't earned them.
Yes, and then he starts doing the assassin-y stuff to finally eliminate the remaining Templars. There is, maybe it happened, you know, off screen or in the novel, but we don't see it on screen like a formal ceremony, do we?
No, I think what you can call Edward's ceremony, or at least his start, is the death of Mary. Because it's not, that's kind of his loss, and that's the loss that really turns him into an assassin.
Yeah. I just say, I know we're here to talk about Odyssey, but as we're talking about Black Flag, Torres, his last words to Kenway when he dies, "You wear your convictions suit you wear them well," something like that.
Something like that.
I didn't get that line, and I've played through Black Flag a couple of times, and it only clicked in my head a few weeks ago when I was mulling it over whilst walking there. I went, "Oh my God, that's a genius line. Can't believe it's taken me like 2 years to figure out why that's such a great line of dialogue." Anyway, it's all about the clothes and what's on the surface and what's on the inside. And anyway, whatever. What were we talking about?
Well, we're supposed to be talking about Odyssey.
Go on, mate. Go on, Declan. Go on.
I was just saying, one thing I did want to quickly say, honestly, before I passed on to James, is I am actually going to say this one thought, then disappear, because I know there's going to be a ruckus. The piece of Eden that Cassandra uses for her abilities, in my opinion, is more logical than the grappling hook in Syndicate and the gun in Assassin's Creed 2.
Ooh, right. Well, it's been lovely hosting the show with you, Declan, but we end the podcast there.
I can't argue your grappling hook. I won't argue that one, but I can argue the gun, because Altair designs that based on what he sees in the apple.
Okay, I did not know that. You didn't have to pull out the lore card.
why do you think Andrew's on this show today? Hey?
Okay, well. Still, I just assume if you've got a gun on your arm, due to the way guns have a recoil system, it would have snapped his wrist unless there was a brace so that could absorb the impact.
To be honest, I'd be afraid to use that. I'd be afraid to use that because one little miscalculation with your powder in that load and you're blowing off your hand. If there's a clog at the end of that barrel, oh boy. Oh boy.
Yeah. It. I have to say, I've never fired a gun. Never even held a gun. Don't really know anything about them. Apart from, the longer the barrel, the higher the muzzle velocity. Potentially, would that give you more? No, it wouldn't give you more. The recoil would always be the same, wouldn't it? Because it'd be about the energy from the gunpowder. But yeah, it's gonna give you a bit of a kick when you fire it. But that is a tiny little gun. It's not going to be very, very accurate. What's the barrel? 2 or 3 inches long? And you'd have to clean it very thoroughly after each firing.
And it's probably a fairly small caliber, probably no bigger than probably 30 caliber.
What's that in euros?
I don't know. Like my first thought is, oh, he's probably just shooting a little 22 and it goes pop. But no, that hand cannon, for lack of a better term, goes boom. So yeah, that would be a very big, like, shocking, I know, to hear this, but I'm an American. So I've held, fired, and own firearms.
Okay.
So I know that kick. There is no way. Like, my dad, when I was growing up, had a 45, like a really big, high-powered pistol. I almost broke my nose with it and never fired it again. So I can only imagine what that pistol would have been like, holding my hand out. No. I'm good.
You're forgetting one important point, Andrew, and that is Ezio Strong. So, you know.
To be fair, and I know this is like a really weird tangent, but I remember when I actually first played Assassin's Creed 2 and they had the gun attachment, it was actually the first time I thought that this doesn't make sense, because I just actually came off the gun range myself from the cadet force. I'd been firing 2.2 rifles all day. So, like, when Ezio's like running around with a gun, I'm like, well, I've just fired a 2.2 rifle. My shoulder's killing me. His wrist must be blowing and knackered by now.
Just a quick Google. A 30 cal would be 7.62 millimeter diameter. Gotcha. So what's that? Like, normal rifles are 5.56, and then machine guns are usually like 12.7 or something millimeter caliber. So it's sort of halfway between a rifle and a handgun.
Yeah, and with how much gunpowder would have been in that, that'd probably be about right, I think. I would just be so worried. I think the books describe it as a wheel lock, so it basically just spins to get a spark. I would be so worried that it would just fall apart and all the powder at my wrist would explode.
Yeah.
I actually think he only uses it once or twice in the books.
It feels like a high risk, high reward. Use this when nothing else. When you've run out of throwing knives, which, let's be honest, are quieter. The throwing knife is the weapon of a sneaky assassin, not the pistol, but use it when you've run out of everything else.
And here's another option of choices. The novel explains all these as attachments. Poison blade is different than the normal blade. It's different. You have to switch them out. So you have to go into your mission going, okay, I'm knowingly taking this pistol and taking this blade off my wrist.
Gotcha. So for you two, Cassandra arriving or starting with this spear that sometimes glows. Actually, it's interesting how the book presents it as it gives her early warning and sort of heightened reactions, and that's about it, as I remember.
I feel like I have a podcast on the spear. So I don't have a podcast on Cassandra herself, because there's always this argument on what do I leave out of from the game, because what's canon, what's not, what is from Alexios's memory, what isn't. So it's very difficult to say what is and what isn't. And I did that podcast before I did before the crossover story came out, and it wiped everything. So I'm like, okay, so this is one of the things in the book. So this is a spear thing. This isn't in the book. So it's probably an Animus hack. Went this way and that way. And then the crossover story is coming out and you go, nah, you can't do any of that. It's all the spear. And I went, well, all right.
Yeah.
But then again,
was it a fun gameplay thing then? You were happy to have it in there as a...
Yeah, I was okay with it. I mean, they set my expectation that it was going to be a little different. We were going back 500 years from the previous game. And it was just something that, from that point of view, I had the expectation that it was going to be play a little differently.
What about you, Declan?
I was over the moon. We're literally going to a country that birthed Zeus and all the magical mumbo jumbo that the Greek hierarchy can throw at us in the pantheon. Having a glowing piece of Eden as your weapon befits ancient Greece so much, because a Greek person could probably find that in a cave and run around with it and then have a story written about him, because that's probably what history would have done. So to me, it's very historically accurate, because if Peace of Eden were real now, some local nutter would probably find it, run around, use it irresponsibly, and have a story written about him.
And so, according to the lore, the last Isu died out about 100 years before this story sets place.
Really?
Because Hermes hands his staff to Pythagoras.
Now, let's jump ahead to Hermes. So, was he known about within the lore before Odyssey?
He was present in the Facebook game. Do you remember in Xerax, I think was his name? He was basically he knew Pythagoras, and Cassandra meets him in the underworld.
I don't remember the name.
Well, there's a memory set of him in the Facebook game. For the life of me, I don't remember the name of it right now.
Is that Project
Legacy?
Yeah.
Yes. And there's he's got a mnemonic set, and you see through that set that Hermes gives Pythagoras his staff.
Okay. That's interesting. So that was, and Project Legacy dates back to
2010.
As far back as that.
Go through the modern day and look at Lucy's computer, she's got it loaded up.
Oh, awesome. So the story of Pythagoras, the staff, and Hermes, that was pre-established many years before the writers of Odyssey even kind of put pen to paper.
Yep.
Okay, that's fascinating.
I doubt they had the idea then of what it could do, but but it's one of those things where at that point, though, most of the pieces of Eden were mind control in some shape or form. I mean, even the swords were said to boost the morale of your troops and lower the morale of your opponents. So,
yeah.
At least now we know where his theorem comes from.
Absolutely. Talk to him by an Isu. Yeah, the staff. Yeah. Yeah. We will come on to the expansion stories and the DLCs, but I want to ask about one more piece of main game stuff. The pyramid that we see in the Cult of Cosmos temple, which is made up of these small triangular I think they're just called artifact fragments.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is we see them in Odyssey, and we collect them. Each cultist carries one, and we collect it, and it boosts the power of our spear at the ancient forge. But we see them again in the crossover story that was added to Valhalla, and we have to collect, I think it's 5 of them, to unlock the vault that's on the Isle of Skye. So it's interesting to see that they returned. But were they pre-established pieces of Isu tech, or was that something new that
was created? That was new for Odyssey.
Understood. And the pyramid kind of showed you certain memories and so on. Again, was that all kind of new stuff?
I think from a memory standpoint, the closest thing that would have been out at that point would have been, other than the Animus, the precursor, the Diglocke, but I think that's all based, which the Diglocke ran off of an Apple of Eden. So I think it all just kind of ties back to calculations and memory thought. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they tie the pyramid to the Animus and the knowledge of it. Because that's essentially what it did, right? I mean, Deimos breaks, has them spill a little blood on it, and it shows them the true memory.
Mm. Yeah.
Isn't this maybe a stretch? Because it just, the blood reminded me a lot of the crystal skulls, was it, from Black Flag?
Yep.
The observatory.
So the observatory, that's a little different, because that if you put a blood vial in the crystal skull, that allows you to see through their eyes and hear through their ears, no matter where they are in the world. And the observatory itself amplifies it with that armillary spear. Which may be another podcast that I've done.
You go ahead, mate. You plug away. It's all good. It's all good. So let's have a look at some of the kind of expansion stuff. So there's kind of several. There's two main stories within Odyssey. There's the quest to find what happened to your family and reunite them, or not, depending on your choices. There's the hunting the cultists. I'm glad I got those. Didn't mess those words up the other way around.
Oh, yeah, that could have been bad.
Yeah, there's hunting the cultists and eliminating the cult of Cosmos across Greece. And then we had, because Odyssey had a year of post-release content and a couple of different streams, so then we had a series of short stories called The Lost Tales of Greece. And you alluded to this earlier, Andrew, which is, if you played the main story and then shut the game down and moved on to another game or many other games, you would never have seen this. But there was a Lost Tale of Greece added, I don't remember when, several months after release, maybe 6 months after release, called, let me get this right. This was the Heir of Memories.
That was number 8.
Right. Okay. Now this adds a lot more kind of interesting stuff in terms of connecting Layla and the Animus to the memories that she's exploring. We'll come to that in a sec, but there's also another quest line, which again you might skip if you just want to play the main story, called the Between Two Worlds quest line. Let's cover that one first. So you meet your father, Pythagoras, in Atlantis, and he sends you off to go and retrieve Atlantis artifacts, which you get from four, well, let's call them monsters, I guess, creatures. The Sphinx, the Minotaur, a Cyclops called Brontes, which means thunder, I think, in Greek, and Medusa. Now, these Atlantis artifacts, which you retrieve from the bodies when you kill these creatures, they look like apples of Eden, are they?
They are not.
Okay, tell us more.
Well, the quickest way of that is just saying, go listen to my podcast on them. Because I break down what they are, the battle.
Hang on a minute. Is that another plug? What's going on here?
Well, this is Let's Talk while Andrew plugs his podcast.
Yeah, Let's Talk Visions of the Past. Love it, mate. Let's do it.
But long story short, what they are is they are artifacts that are more of a key. They go into a, I guess for lack of a better term, a plinth to seal the lost city of Atlantis. What they do is they transform their holder into a Greek mythological beast to better protect themselves. Now, the only way that, at least now that we're talking about it, there's two ways that Cassandra is able to hold that off. I believe it's got more to do with her high concentration of Isu DNA, her classification as a hybrid, but it could also be because of the spear. So we see that a little bit more in, we see a few other ones in the Fate of Atlantis, and it ties that story into another story with Juno and Aeta. And they're really mostly designed to protect the last known Isu city.
So that's why they were creating these monsters as defense.
Well, I think that monster, that project, Olympios, had two. It was originally built to basically create something to keep the human slaves in line. And then I think Poseidon decided that they would be better off used to seal off his city. That is, of course, if you that you connect those dots in how much you believe in the Fate of Atlantis DLC.
Yeah.
I think that would... I think it makes a lot of sense for them to be used as both guardians and to keep humans in line. Because from a human standpoint, humans' brains compared to Aesir probably would have reacted a lot more of fear and hope than what Aesir would have. So having a sort of figurehead like a Medusa to create stories, to create fear, would probably keep humans in line. But from my understanding, Poseidon probably would have thought it was more of a barbaric method, because it did just seem, from what I understand, a bit of a peace between them. So guardians would be a great way to keep humans in line from exploring, because humans will create any story out of anything, because we're human. But I don't know, I'm not really a fan of Fate of Atlantis anyways.
Well, if you take Fate of Atlantis out of it and just keep it into the main game, what better way to keep your keys hidden than with a monster that everyone is afraid of and refuses to go near? Look at the Medusa battle, how everybody on that island is afraid. And the only reason we even go deeper into that forest is because that one lady is looking for her best friend, her lover. I don't quite remember how that story played out, but
it's her lover. Because they quote the poet Sappho when they're when they find her. She says, "Someone I tell you in another time will remember us," which I think is Sappho.
So yeah, I mean, what better way to hide your key to your lost kingdom, so to speak, than to put it in a monster that everyone's afraid of, and that nobody can use the key because they turn into that monster after they kill it.
It's like the ultimate paradox. To beat the monster, you become the monster.
Yep.
Ooh.
That's like the ultimate paradox as a defense mechanism. You can't be what you will become.
And the only way that you can use that key is if you essentially come from that city, come from that civilization.
Mm. Oh, that's trippy. That just got me thinking, like, philosophically, it could mean that the monsters themselves represent them as higher beings than humans, and the Isu are higher than monsters. So the Isu are just putting themselves on a bigger pedestal, saying, hey, we're bigger than monsters and we're bigger than humans.
Yep. And with that coming from Aida and Juno, absolutely.
So in this sense, this mythology is more science than mythology, because technically, humans give the Isu names, so these mythologies didn't come from humans just waking up one day. They came up from Isu that we were just too scared of, so we made our own stories.
Right, and it comes, and those stories would have gone mouth to mouth for long, many, many generations. It would have been an oral tradition, and it wouldn't have been until Homer, maybe, his time, that they would have been put to paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then still been changed a little bit. And that's essentially the basis of, once again, my podcast on religion in Assassin's Creed. Because they all come from either the Isu or one of their artifacts.
Because it is a known fact in lore, and I know you could correct me, Andrew, that when the Isu died out and there was the remaining survivors of humans, the Isu did try and teach the humans the knowledge. But because humans didn't have like pen, paper, telephones, computers, the story of, I'm just going to use two names, Jim and Bob having a boxing match would have evolved from Jim and Bob to having a boxing match to 500 cultures down the line of Jim punched a dragon called Bob. It's just a progression of the world that they changed him to fit into how they see fit. What's more intended for humans to retell one story? Which kind of shows that it's not that Assassin's Creed is stealing mythology and hammer it into Isu lore. They're just trying to say, well, what if the mythology you've got was just created so humans had a way of understanding Isu lore?
And that's really what it is. It's just that, what if? What if this isn't from what we believe? It's what if it came from, for lack of a better term, the ancient alien thought process? And they take, and I remember I have a comment on probably the religion one, that someone was very adamant that I was wrong and that you couldn't do different mythologies based all off of Isu, even though it's all a perception. So it's all a matter of what if this person over here did this one thing, but person A sees it differently than person B, and they go their separate ways and start telling their stories differently. We even see that in the Forgotten Myths comic that just came out for Dawn of Ragnarok. Each of those story pops out at least once an issue and goes, oh, but I heard it told differently by so-and-so. That's not how so-and-so wrote it down. So it makes you question, is this really what happened? Could it have happened that way? How? Why? What changed?
Sounds like the Isu version of Dag. All his boat stories, everyone was like, are you sure that happened?
How do you walk 25 miles uphill both ways from school? Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yes, yes. It always made sense to me that effectively what every human culture, let's say at Cassandra's time or at Bayek's time or even at Eivor's time, all human cultures had a common ancestry or a common belief system, but 75,000 years is a long, long time.
Yep.
And you know, actually, it makes sense that they all look back to a common belief, I don't know, in a sky god or a sun god, yep, or a rain god or a fertility god or whatever, and then they get gradually adapted over 75,000 years. It made sense to me. It never really seemed to be any other logical explanation. Although I will just say, on the point of arguments, I did once have an argument with someone, I think it was on Twitter. Someone told me that the Animus doesn't create a simulation. Well, what is it
what?
Doing then? Yeah, I know. Anyway, I gave up but trying to convince the way, them otherwise.
your comment actually did remind me of exactly what it was. It was about, I talked about how the humans are all different because we're all based on different pockets of Isu civilizations. Yeah. Yeah. That they all created their own first humans, went to a central location, and that's how they would create humans. And I had someone tell me, you can't break down each human races or something similar to that effect based on Isu cults that were all from one. And I just went, this isn't meant to be taken literally. This is not real.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry, just Andrew's thought then is just going to be thinking that makes the most logical sense. Like, you could have a human that's got more hair than someone else because the Isu could have took them to a northern climate where they would need hair to stay warm, where the other pocket of humans took to a hot place where they don't really need any more hair.
Or so, they spoke a different Isu dialect, so yeah, the human slaves pick up a different language.
Oh my god, that would make so much logical sense. Maybe bald people were just in a hot place and they didn't need all that hair.
Except you would think they'd need the hair to keep from burning on top.
Yeah, but the Isu can't get everything right.
All
right.
Poseidon had lost most of his hair on top of his head, so we know the least some Isu went bald.
Yep.
One of them was called Balder, for God's sakes. Or was it Balder? I don't know. Anyway, that's a really bad
joke. You'd have
to
ask Louise on that one.
I'll tell you what, as we're talking about Atlantis and so on, let's jump right into that. So, Fate of Atlantis, three chapters. Cassandra, through the staff, she sees, I guess, that they're simulations within the simulation, aren't they?
They are.
Elysium, Hades, and Atlantis.
Yep.
We don't know if the Isu city really looked like that. My guess is it didn't. It was kind of a mixture of probably what some of it looked like, but adapted to look
vaguely. Alethea comments that she made changes to based on Cassandra's perception of those. No, what just happened? Oh, don't die. Oh my goodness. My computer went black and I thought it died.
Oh, you're right, mate. We can still hear you. If we, when you're ready, we'll just resume and Declan can cut that bit out.
Declan's not going to edit that out. He's going to be like, you're going to have fun with that.
Declan's just here like,
we'll put in the video description, tune in to about 1:10 if you want to hear Andrew shit his pants.
Yeah, let's roll the mouse. Oh, by the way,
just to say for our American listeners, in the UK, pants are your underwear. Your trousers are your pants. You know, I always love the line that the USA and the UK are two languages, two countries separated by a common language. Anyway, yep. Yeah.
Boot, pants. Bonnet, buggy. Yeah, it's so much fun. Anyway,
I just want to say biscuits and gravy. That's weird, guys. Sorry, Americans. Yeah. You don't have gravy on biscuits.
No, biscuits and gravy are gross. No, just don't at me on that. No.
All right.
I don't like soggy bread.
All right.
But anyway, I was.
What were we doing?
Before I freaked out.
Before your laptop shit its pants or your computer, what were we doing? Fate of Atlantis and all that stuff.
So, yeah. Alethea made a comment to Cassandra that she altered the simulation that she was going to go into based on her knowledge of mythology, which I always had a problem with because Cassandra, throughout the game, showed nothing about knowing or caring about the Greek mythology.
Yes,
that was all that bit Barnabas, and that irked me so much. And the problem I have with the Fate of Atlantis is different than Declan's problem with the Fate of Atlantis. My issue is you don't know what's real and what's not. Because with Alethea's comment about creating the simulation, you realize that what Cassandra is seeing isn't necessarily true. And instead of Layla sitting down into those same machines, she's told her mind can't handle it and needs to do it through the Animus. So you're reviewing, you're in a simulation to do another simulation created by an Isu who you don't know is being truthful to you or not.
Yeah, she was, her story was became a lot clearer and her objective became clarified in Valhalla, but I always felt she was a bit sketchy in Odyssey. Can you really trust this spectral apparition of someone that's talking to you through a staff? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I had more notes and I need to turn over the page. So this is going to be some good sound effects for the recording.
I know it's a different actress, but she sounded so much like Juno that I couldn't get behind her. What she was saying sounded nice, but at that point we had only seen two Isu that we could kind of take whole granted with Minerva and Jupiter, but the main one, Juno, you couldn't trust anything that she said. She flat out told Desmond, oh, if you die, I'm getting out. But if you don't die, here's what's going to happen to the world. Ha ha ha. Like you could just see her twirling her mustache at that point.
Cue evil mustache quote. I do want to make, I think we're all like kind of glossing over how technically Fate of Atlantis kind of broke the number one continuity rule of the franchise.
Are you saying it broke the law?
It just broke the number one rule.
I'm messing with you, mate, because that's the usual quote, isn't it? Odyssey broke the law. Okay.
I would actually say Fate of Atlantis broke the law in the sense of they forced players to pay money to get the correct ending of modern day. And if you don't,
yes,
and you then played, if you're like me and can't afford DLCs, and you then went and bought Valhalla, they've broke continuity because the continuity of the staff does not line up, and that is breaking law, because the law of how main game ends compared to how DLC ends is completely different. So the law of Layla getting staff Cassandra, and then something bad has happened with Valhalla, is a really big continuity issue that shouldn't exist. The fact that you have to pay £39 for the season pass to understand it or get it separate for £20 is a douche move. It's worse than any of the microtransactions in Valhalla, in my opinion. And it's the only thing I hate about Odyssey.
And I totally get where you're coming from. And it's actually not the first one to finish a modern day story. You guys talked with Luis last week. At least I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago.
We did. Yeah, Jack the Ripper.
And there was one comment where you were like, there's no modern day here. When there is. The modern day of Syndicate ends with Rebecca getting shot. And we know she survives through notes in Jack the Ripper.
Oh, really? Okay, yes. There's actually extra. How do you access those notes? Are they in
I think they're in the database, but they come along as the story progresses.
Okay, gotcha.
But my understanding would be, because the modern day doesn't jump from Syndicate to Origins, that maybe that type isn't... It's a douche move. You shouldn't fish endings in a DLC. But maybe that one's a little less intrusive because the storyline never picks up. Whereas with Odyssey, Valhalla taken directly after the events of Fate of Atlantis...
You're right. If you don't play Fate of Atlantis, you don't understand why Layla looks like... she's in withdrawal. You don't understand the line from Sean about what happens to Victoria. You don't understand why there's a deleted audio file of Otso Berg, his interrogation, inside her computer. So I totally get it.
I think that's the second issue Valhalla, Odyssey had with some of the missions, and I think James may have notes, but I've heard there's a lot of issues with the Hidden Ones deal. Is it Hidden Ones? No. First Blade.
Legacy DLC. Of the First Blade. I do want to come to that, yeah. Yeah.
I think that'd probably be the last topic we look at.
Before we leave Atlantis, though, I'm curious to get your opinions on, as a new player, I was meeting all of these characters for the first time. So you're in Atlantis, you're doing work for Poseidon, you are acting as the judge, the Dicastes, and you're doing stuff, and you meet these characters called Juno and Aeta, who I'd never seen before. What was your impression of them, and how they were presented in the game?
They felt like Easter eggs for the hardcore. And I say that because what they're doing is kind of par the course for who they are, have been established to be. But it feels like you're expected to get more after that, but we get nothing. Like, we learn later that Juno turns out to be Hurricane.
Oh, yes, yes.
But you don't know that unless you match the voices. But it feels like that project Olympos, or the Olympos project, however which way it goes, that is meant to be something bigger. Like, there's more to it than the four monsters in the main game, the werewolf, Cerberus, and the Hecacontres. It just feels like there's supposed to be more, and that they're trying to give you more information on what the Isu were like. It's just odd to me on how it feels like there should be more and then there's not.
What I don't remember is, does Cassandra kind of, does she judge, does she try to stop what Juno and Aita are doing?
That's one of the choices in the game.
Is it? Okay. Yep.
You can choose to try to stop it, or you can choose to leave. Just like you can choose to fight Math Daddy.
I didn't know there was... I don't remember there being... Actually, yes, there are. I remember, because I had always fought him, and then I must have taken different dialogue choices, and he just gave me the staff willingly on my last playthrough, which I didn't realize was an option.
Yep.
But yeah. Let's quickly jump over to Legacy of the First Blade, and there's a couple of things I want to call out, which is we get to meet Darius, who we've already met in AC2 in the vault as a statue.
When Odyssey was announced, that was one of my most anticipated things. I was like, this is 30 years after the death of Xerxes. Will we get to meet Darius? Will we truly? Mm. And then we come to find out, like, everything on that statue is wrong about the man.
Tell us what's wrong.
The way he wears his blade, everything is wrong. And Origins, the DLC, the Hidden Ones, they went out of their way to make Amunet look like her statue.
See, I don't think Amunet in Origins looks, apart from the distinctive hairstyle, I don't think
the hairstyle and the headdress is the big one.
Yeah. I just don't think she looks like her. But
the going on that with Darius, nope. I think the statue, he's got a turban on.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Would you rather that in game he had a turban, or would you rather he had the hood of an assassin?
Because I actually am very happy with the way they did it, because you have at that point almost 2,000 years to explain. Well, it's not like someone drew him and we have a paper of it. I mean, look at that Bayek. He wears the blade wrong, and it's supposed to be that blade, and cuts off his finger.
Yeah.
This just reminded me of a chat in Sisterhood where I think we all discussed that Bayek cut his own finger off by accident and then forced everyone to do it afterwards as part of, like, tradition.
Instead of just admitting he'd screwed up, he made everyone else copy him.
Except he didn't.
He didn't screw up.
No, he did. Cutting his finger off was absolutely a mistake. What I'm saying is he didn't force anyone else to do it. I don't remember if it's the beginning of the Hidden Ones or if it's the end of the main story. One of the people goes to, one of his recruits goes to cut off his finger, and he tries to stop them, and she shrugs him off and says, "No, I'm dedicated like you are."
Oh, yes. That's in the Hidden Ones DLC, I think. Okay.
What was... The biggest issue out of the Hidden Ones for me was the idea of the DNA changing Natakis to his sister. And for the life of me, I can't remember her name because I've never played as Alexios.
Nima.
So
her name is Nima.
I know this created a big splash when it came out, but I didn't have a problem with the forced relationship. Like, I get why people did, because you were told throughout the whole story, it's your Odyssey, you can romance who you want, nobody, everybody, doesn't matter. Yeah. And then they force you into that one. And what is worse to me is they take that pregnancy, that baby, Lipidos, and tie it into Aya.
Why is that worse? I'm curious.
Aya didn't need it. That's telling, tries to tell the community that Aya is only special because of Cassandra. That's like saying that Desmond is only special because of Altair, because of Ezio, because of Ratakahetan. It's the chosen one trope. Or chosen one? I think, Well, In Star Wars, it's the chosen one. It's that whole trope about being special because of your bloodline.
Bloodline, yeah. Go on, Declan.
I think this is where I may be the worst person to actually open my mouth because I never played the DLC. But when I did research into it, I kind of just felt it worked really well on the basis that not Cassandra was her mum. Like, I didn't click on that to the very end. I was just more focused at the time on, like, Darius raised that kind of lineage. It was like, did he just teach the kids to be respectful, you know, like, about good and evil, and when what happened with her son and with Bayek, that's when she started to realize, well, okay, I've had years of understanding that the world isn't black and white, the world is grey, there is evil people, there is good people. Maybe we need to do something now. So maybe I'm the wrong person, but I always kind of looked at it more about through Darius's legacy than Cassandra's.
Which I can see, because that explains actually the Magi, where they get their code, where they get their abilities, and where that hidden blade comes from, and why it's all been passed down to Bayek and Aya. But you didn't need to make them genetically linked.
That I can agree with, to be honest. Like, it's a weird one, and as I didn't play the DLC, I think I'm probably the only fan that kind of skirts over the genetic link and just looks at Darius's lineage as being that technically Aya is just a badass character in general.
Yeah,
she's had this amazing lineage and she's decided to go her own way. Then she's got a husband that F's up and cuts his finger off, and now we have hundreds of thousands of generations to do the same thing. It's a magical legacy.
Yeah. So there's good things and bad in both of them, in both the DLC. But I can understand why people have claimed that Odyssey breaks the lore. It's all on perception and expectation. And when you market the game behind Alexios and then go, but Cassandra's really the canon character, you kind of break that.
I mean, that's a very fair criticism.
To be honest, on that criticism, I think what makes it worse is not that they said Cassandra was canon. It's one of the things that I think any RPG that has multiple choice should never do, because it is horrible. You don't make a canon book and then publish it next to a game with multiple endings and then say, actually, you've spent 500 hours, there's your ending, there's your characters, Alexios. But buy our book and you'll realize Cassandra's canon and all your choices are wrong, and this is the canon story.
And then they go, and by the way, the best ending in the game isn't the canon ending.
No, that's true. That's true.
You got to pay £30 for a DLC.
And you know, just on that point, that's something that I've seen from time to time on the subreddit. You know, because every now and then there'll be a discussion, you know, which character did you choose to play as? And most people will say, I picked this one and then I did a new game plus, played as the other one, so I could experience both. Or I did my research and I decided to play as the canon character. Or, you know, some people will say, look, I just like playing as the guy, or I just like playing as the girl. I don't care about the canon. So, you know, there's all ranges of choices. But what's interesting is every now and then you'll get someone who will sort of come into these threads. And basically their comment is, hang on a minute, WTF, I've spent 100 hours playing as Alexios and I've been playing as the wrong character. I'm annoyed. Why didn't the game tell me? I want to be clear, I'm not criticizing the writers here. I think it's fair to say, and there are members of the dev team who are on record saying that the game was intended to be a Cassandra game from the start. Alexios was added at the request, I would assume, of editorial in Ubisoft Paris.
This is no disrespect to
those that choose or prefer to play as Alexios, not at all. But certainly we would have had a more, what's the right word? Coherence, the wrong word. I think the storytelling, the acting, the NPCs that you bounce off of could have all been much more...
It would have come together better. I mean,
yeah, because it is, everything is written around that female protagonist.
Yep, and the way that I chose Cassandra because I liked the way the voice acting sounded. It was better to me. But you go through different stories with her and you get to like Achaebaltes in Corinthia and his side mission there for lack of a better term, the toy. And you wonder where that comes from.
I think it was called.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the clips with Alexios, that just comes off forced and wrong. It's not a knock against the voice acting. It's just the way being forced is playing a guy in that mission particularly doesn't sound right.
I think for me, because I just play Cassandra because I bought the book, so I just play Cassandra because the book told me to. I know, wrong answer, but from all the cutscenes, the death of Phoebe always hits harder from Cassandra than Alexios.
Yeah, it does.
Because to me, the relationship's more like a sister. Like when I watched YouTube plays Alexios and there's that whole Plague Town mission where if you kill them, she like turns away from you. Alexios, it just looks like two friends. But when I did it as Cassandra, I was like, oh, I've just left like my only family. Like she's more like my sister and I'm annoyed her. And that hit hard. I was like, yeah. Oh, I think I've just upset my sister. This is bad. And again, I'm not knocking it. I think praise to both of the voice actors and everyone who's played as both characters. But my personal experience with Phoebe, when she died, you got more emotion from Cassandra because that's like a sister to her.
Yeah, yeah. I've done one playthrough as Alexios and multiple as Cassandra. I think I picked Cassandra first and therefore she will always be imprinted on me as the protagonist, and Alexios will always be Deimos. I'm happy with my choice.
And
you know, and I do think Melisandre Mahut, when she is Deimos, she does a great performance as the terrifying Deimos as well. So either way works. Anyway, we've been recording for quite a long time. It's nearly 1 a.m. for us, Declan. I think we should probably close the show.
There is one thing that I did like out of the DLC.
Ooh, one last thing. This is like an Apple presentation.
And it just shows the idea with Layla and the bleeding effect, doing the Deimos mission, showing what that does to her.
Forgot to mention that one. Damn it.
But yeah, I just wanted to point that out, that that's at least one of the better things of the DLC.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would have been a good structure to the game. You play as Cassandra and then the Animus says, I found another DNA stream. And then maybe you play a short series of stories as Deimos.
But kind of like how they did it with Origins with Bayek and Aya.
Yeah. 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 That would have been quite cool.
So, sadly, that is all we've got time for tonight, I believe. And I really want to play Odyssey now, but I can't.
Do it.
I don't have enough room on my Xbox for Odyssey because of Valhalla.
That's a big game. 110 gigabytes.
Yeah, like I've had to delete LEGO Star Wars just to fit Valhalla onto my Xbox.
And now I'm missing LEGO Star Wars. That's why I have a 2 terabyte external hard drive.
Well, I'm poor. I've only got a 500.
It was a gift.
Mine's 512 gigabyte on the Series S.
Yeah, that's difficult.
Yeah, all I can fit on it is one Ezio games, Black Flag, Valhalla, Elden Ring, and that's it. That's all I can fit onto it. Okay, Unity. Anyways,
video games are big nowadays. I remember when SimCity 2000 was on 2 floppy disks, but anyway, that was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
Back in the 60s. I mean, what?
Oi. Protect your elders.
I feel like an elder. I've got 2 dodgy knees and I'm only 27. Thank you for joining us, Andrew. Odyssey is a diverse game, but always respect everyone's opinions, please, because this is Assassin's Creed. You're just meant to have fun. Please don't take it too seriously. We would love to hear your thoughts. You can email us at assassinscreedletstalk@gmail.com, or you can message us on Twitter at @ACLetstalk or at @JamesTillyQuinn. And if you have an urge to splurge and go into the Greek Odyssey yourself, swing by Cedar Keys using the link in the description where we get a little bit of money for anything you buy, because Odyssey is on sale. You can get the full game, no DLCs, on Xbox from £54 down to £19, or if you want the gold edition for PC from £69 to £16. Good deals to get into Odyssey. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
See you all soon.
Have a great night.